I'm Kevin Power, and this is Sascapes, the podcast featuring stories of arts, culture, and heritage in Saskatchewan. This episode of Sascapes is sponsored by the Saskatchewan Association of Theatre Professionals, supporting Saskatchewan's performing arts and artists, and promoting Saskatchewan talent across Canada and around the world. So, as an actor, I often feel an inner cringe when I mention the name of a high-profile director or actor with whom I've worked. But, you know, it doesn't have to be, air quotes, name-dropping when the work you've done is a sign of your years of hard work, dedication, and passion. So it's in that spirit that I'd like to begin the introduction to my guest by saying this. Among the many young people with whom he has worked, Emmy Award-winning Orphan Black star and pride of Saskatchewan, Tatiana Maslany is one of them. And I happen to think that's pretty great. To have inspired a young actor through your method of training and watched them flourish confirms that the work you're doing makes a difference. My guest for this episode is playwright, theater director, teacher, and, well, he's a mentor, too, and so much more, Dan McDonald. His body of work is impressive, and we talk about much of that work in this episode. This is the third in a Sascapes Present special series featuring theater in Saskatchewan. I love these conversations. They remind me of why I chose to be a singer and an actor. If you'd like to hear the first two in this series, go back and listen to episode 94 with Henry Wolfe and 96 with Yvette Nolan. Dan clearly loves what he does, and anyone with whom he has worked or will work can't help but be influenced by his generosity, insight, and infectious energy. So, here's Dan McDonald. Dan McDonald, welcome to the Sascapes podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm going to toot your horn for you and save you the breath. You are an award-winning and, I might add, prolific playwright. You're a director. You're a teacher. You've taught in high school. You teach at the U of S. You've written countless number of plays. Your work has been performed across Canada, the U.S., the U.K. You've worked in film and television as an actor. You've been a casting director. You have won numerous awards for your playwriting, and I will put all of those in the show notes so people can learn a little more about you. And you are former board member with the Playwrights Canada Press and former president of the Saskatchewan Playwrights Center. You've done some artistic associate work with Persephone Theatre, and you're from the Maritimes.
That's correct, boy.
As am I.
That's right.
As am I, my trout, and you're the first Maritime guest I've ever had.
I'm honored. That is incredible.
So if we were allowed to be seen in public because of this stupid pandemic, we can't be, we'd be putting the kettle on and sitting in the tea and you know, sitting
That's
in
right.
the kitchen having some tea and...
Exactly.
Finding out eventually that we're related, of course.
That's right, too. I'm sure we are. Everybody is down there anyways.
Everybody is. Not that there's any inbreeding going on. It's just...
No.
Now, you're from PEI.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So where did you grow up on the island?
Well, I didn't... Okay, so I was born on the island, spent all my summers on the island. My mom lives on the island, as do pretty much all of my relatives on both sides of my family. But I grew up in Quebec City in the winter. So I went to school in Quebec, and then we would summer in the island because my mom, well, my dad too, for that matter, they're both from the island. So we would, as soon, like literally the day when school would end in Quebec, we'd be heading to the island for the summer pretty much.
So basically, you put your foot down and said, if I have to live in two places, I'd like to live in two of the most gorgeous places in the country.
That's right. That's how it turned out. And I got to learn French along the way. So, you know, it was a good deal all around.
That's pretty great. So what'd your folks do?
My dad was a philosophy professor and in Quebec. So he taught at a college in Quebec City. I grew up in a suburb of Quebec City called Saint-Foy. And so that's why we lived there. He studied at Laval University, ended up teaching there. So we were there. My mom was a nurse. She started nursing at the Jeffrey Hale Hospital in Quebec City, and then subsequently had eight kids. So she just became the mom of our dreams and raised eight kids while my dad taught. That's basically how that went down.
So I'm wondering if the influence of philosophy somehow informed some of your insight on how you move through life as an artist.
Well, interestingly, I have a philosophy degree. I do not have a theater. I have a theater degree, but it's a master's in directing. I do not have an undergraduate theater degree. So even though I grew up in Quebec City and spent my summers in PEI, I immediately went back to the Maritimes to study when I could. So I went to the University of Nova Scotia and did a philosophy degree. That was kind of interesting because I think I did it because my dad was a philosopher and I wanted to impress him, but I spent all my time in the theater at Theatre Antigonish in Nova Scotia and did tons of theater and paid very scant attention to my studies because I was in the theater pretty much all the time. So I kind of told you what I probably should have been doing, but what I did do was get a philosophy degree. I don't know. Like, you know, it does the way that writers write and the way that they think, they tend to be inspired by what they perceive the world to be doing and want to say something about the way they see the world. So there is an aspect to being philosophical for any writer, I guess, and trying to make sense of some of the bigger questions. So there's certainly a link for a lot of people.
I agree. We're very curious about the human condition.
Yes. And we spend a lot of time watching, and I always found myself being slightly distanced or distancing myself and taking something in, even though I was participating in it. I would find myself slightly out of it, not really out of it, but slightly out of the picture as I started to take in what this was. And whether or not I was going to use it in some way as an aspect of writing, I'm not sure, but I certainly would spend a lot of time watching or taking something in and letting it unfold as an event rather than me just being a participant in it.
Tell me about your first live theater experience as an audience member.
It's very, very clear because it was not just my first live theater experience, but it turned into my first writing or playwriting experience. So my dad, like I said, was teaching at a college, and he took myself and my big sister to a play at the college, Barefoot in the Park, the Neil Simon play. And they had a really great reputation at the college for fairly high-end productions. And I sat through, I was in grade six. I was 11 years old. And I sat through Barefoot in the Park, a romping kind of comedy, and immediately went home and wrote a play and took it to school. I don't know how long it took me to write this thing. Took it to school and got my teacher, Sister Anna, to let me have a reading of the play with a few students. So we sat in a circle and we read the play. So that was completely derivative of Barefoot in the Park, from what I remember, which would be hilarious. Right. A bunch of 11-year-olds doing Barefoot in the Park. But that was really what my first theater experience, the first one I remember as an observer, for sure.
Mermaid Theater was the first theater experience I had. They were performing.
Oh, yeah.
They were performing at Neptune, and they were doing a black box theater presentation. This is before the famous People Players were around, I think, even.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
I was captivated by it. And like you, running home and wanting to replicate in some form or fashion what you just saw with the Neil Simon play, I came home and I told my mom and dad, I need to do this in the living room. So my mom doesn't remember this, but I made her dye all these sheets black to drape over the, over the windows and make me a black, basically long black robe type thing and a black hood that would go right over my head.
Yeah.
And I had this sort of glow-in-the-dark neon puppet. And I got my dad to buy me a light. And what he bought me was a floodlight. And then we had a few family members over. So basically, picture this. You're in a living room dressed in black and you put a floodlight on. All I achieved was lighting the room up like a nuclear explosion had just happened. And everybody sat there watching me walk around with myself draped in black with this puppet.
Right. Right.
And I'm thinking I'm invisible, much like the kid. If you put your hands over your eyes, you're not there anymore.
That's right. Yeah.
So I didn't quite grasp the concept of the black box and how it worked, but it did influence me. So for you, it sounds like just that experience alone tells me that playwriting must have just been in your DNA.
Yeah, you know, and then just on the heels of that, my brother, who is a theater artist and a film artist in Vancouver, my brother and I just started doing plays in the neighborhood. And there were four or five boys, all boys, who essentially created a theater company. And we would do plays constantly for the neighbors, for moms and kids. And we would do them in our garage, at our house. And we would invite everybody. And I wrote several plays that my brother starred in when we were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. Yeah, that's exactly what we did, which is odd because I was in a certain way. I mean, my family had no arts background whatsoever, really. I mean, and I was a jock. I was into sports like crazy. Mm. And there was very little high school drama. There was no high school drama when I went to high school in Quebec City. And so I just became a jock and didn't go from that point, from when I was like an 11-year-old or 12-year-old till I was 18, I didn't do any drama. There was nothing going on until I got into college, into Cégep, actually, in Quebec.
Hey, it's Kevin. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just a quick reminder that the SaaScapes podcast is available for free on your favorite podcast app, or you can stream it from your browser. Check out the show notes for the link. On the SaaScapes homepage, you'll notice something new under the logo called SaaScapes Plus. You can't miss it. There's a big button saying support with a heart icon next to it. I'd love it if you could click on that button and help keep this podcast series going. When SaaScapes launched in May 2014, it was the first podcast in the province celebrating arts, culture, and heritage. In fact, you'd have been pretty hard-pressed to find any Saskatchewan podcasts. So I'd like to think that we paved the way. It's been because of your support that this podcast is now in its 9th year. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Okay, so fast forward to your more grown-up years. When did you start playwriting in earnest with the intention of getting your work published and getting your work performed?
Well, it's a slightly complicated question, and I'll divide it into two components. I didn't take myself seriously as a playwright until I wrote what I would consider a serious play that got produced at Alberta Theatre Projects in their new play festival, Blitz Weekend and all of that. So ATP had a huge festival for quite a few years. And I wrote a play called Pageant. And I would say that was my first, I was in my mid-30s, and that was my first real serious attempt at a play and first real dramatic experience at a real serious theater. And that festival was huge. It's no longer running as a festival anymore, but it was you know, people came shopping for plays there. You'd meet people from all over the country. Theater artists came. There were big drunken parties and hangouts, and it was just crazy. And artists from all over the place, because there'd be four new plays, what ATP considered the best new submissions in Canada that year, and they would produce them, had four big productions of them, and they would run in rep for a month and a half. So that was my first foray into playwriting in a serious way. But dial back 15 years, and I'm a 20-year-old working in the Maritimes, in PEI, and then in Nova Scotia and Halifax, doing feasts, doing the Governor's Feast and the Flyers Feast in PEI, and then Grafton Street Dinner Theatre in Halifax as a director-writer. And I'm in my early 20s, and I am writing voraciously because I have to. I've been hired. I was an actor for them, for these companies first, and then they got me on as a writer-director a few years in. And I wrote comedies for dinner theater for several years as a young man, and learned my chops as a writer doing that, because you had no choice. You had a week, 2 weeks at the most, to slam a comedy together that was going to run all summer for tourists, et cetera, and locals and stuff like that. And you had to deliver, and it had to be funny, and it had to move. And I have to tell you, that was in some ways the biggest learning curve and the best teacher that I could possibly have had, because I can sit down, and that's the one thing that I've learned about aspiring writers and aspiring playwrights, is the muscle that it takes to sit down and write and not let up, right? Not get down on, it's not working, I'm just going to toss this away. So that's where I learned it. And then during that time, these business guys from out west had heard of the Governor's Feast in PEI and saw a show and hired me to come out west into Regina and start up a much bigger version of the dinner theater that we were running in the Maritimes. And I moved out west to Regina. And that's pretty much my story, like in terms of how I got out west from the Maritimes and what I did for the first few years that I was here. I ran a theater company called Celebrations in Regina, and then kind of got out of that eventually and started teaching. But that was really learning how to sit down and pound out a show, mostly musical or musical related. That was really where I did it. So by the time I didn't take myself seriously as a writer, because I thought, oh, this is just fluffy comedies and stuff like that. It's paying the bills, all that kind of thing. And then by the time I went, I think I want to write something for me, I want to take myself seriously, I had all of those, that writing muscle, those chops under me, at least in terms of being able to sit and write and not let up and go and go. That was really ingrained in me. So the challenge was then structure and writing something serious that didn't need to go for the comedy jugular, or you didn't have to rely on a song to bridge scenes or something like that. That was the new challenge, was content. So that was really what brought me from one place to the next, was in terms of writing, was those two experiences.
Now, in all of these cases, were you able to not only write the work, but were you able to direct all of them, or did you have to hand them off to other directors?
I almost always directed them, and that was not by any reason other than budget economy. It was just a given that that's what you did. And I had no choice. So certainly it taught me directing skills as well. But of course, you're learning without any, like, I had no directing background or degree. I had done some directing on my own at the university, at Theatre Antigonish, directing new plays or directing one act plays for the festivals that they did and stuff like that. But so you're just combining the two. So anything that I didn't get written in a draft before rehearsal, we would just fix in rehearsal, you know, and that happened a lot. And that is actually it's so much more formalized now than it was, but that was really a standard practice for so many theater artists over the centuries, right? Nobody wrote and then handed it off to a director and that kind of thing. The director was a writer, Shakespeare was writing and then getting it on the stage and all that kind of thing. So So that's a common thing, and it's become more common. Part of that is because I have done the other thing where I'd write a play and then hand it off and watch them fuck it up and be really pissed off and go, I don't, like, what are you doing to my play? That is not, you know, that kind of thing. And being that, but there was a tradition, it's no longer there, where the writer was asked to shut up and sit in the play in the rehearsal hall and not say anything, and maybe the director would consult with them, maybe not, and you tried to be polite and smile and take it all. And I think that has changed significantly over the years, although it's still a case within some cases. But I think a lot of writers now, because I see it professionally, a lot of playwrights have, you know, such a variety of skills now, and they're directors and they're creators and they're designers, and it's so interesting to see how that's evolved. So I think it's come from several directions in terms of playwrights directing their own work or directors learning to write, et cetera, et cetera. But it's certainly something that's been fascinating to me, for me to watch.
Conveniently, you've pretty much answered my next question, but I just want to get into the weeds of that topic a bit more based on my own experience of the new work development that I've done mostly out of the Banff Center, is that I've experienced both sides of the coin, where cases where the writer is sitting in the back row of the theater, chomping away on their fingernails, watching their work be mutilated, with the, you know, thinking, this is not what I intended. And I'm wondering, much like an editor has to slash away at a novel, I wonder if there is, at the core of that process, at least some validity to it, if there is, for the lack of a better word, just extraneous stuff there that the author, it made sense, but it's just it's unnecessary. It sort of it takes things off, makes the play too long or something. Is there a happy medium where you go, okay, I'm just going to trust this director and turn my piece over to him or her and just trust that in the end that their version resembles mine, and maybe I walk away thinking, wow, I think it's actually better than I thought it would be.
Yeah. I learned that too. And I learned that the hard way. If you trust a director, I think there's, and you learn to collaborate with them. I think of Daniel McIver and Daniel Brooks, for example, and there's tons of people who have fantastic relationships with a director or a few directors, and they have no problem moving the work. And they look at the work as a kind of on a continuum, right? If you look at the work on a continuum where the writing slowly moves into a variety of phases that take it from just on the page to at the table to getting it on its feet to bringing in props to, right? So there's this continuum of development, and that the director is a part of that continuum from early on, if not from the very beginning. Then there's this incredible trust and understanding that's being built between the playwright and the director. And that may be a relationship that they've cultivated over many years, you know, that. And so I have directors that I love and would be happy to work with and just kind of be the playwright. But just as there's a directing continuum, there can be a playwright continuum as well, in which the playwright, it no longer looks like writing anymore. It's now conceiving, and oh, what if we do this with this section visually or design? So the idea of teaming up with a team of artists and building the work that way is exactly how building a production makes sense. There is an old style that still exists for sure, and it's partly because of budget and all of that kind of thing. But that old style for sure is, okay, thank you, You've written your play. You probably, and the sense by the director or the producers that the playwright really doesn't know what they've written. We'll make it good now. We'll now take it to the next level. And sometimes that absolutely happens. And the playwright is so grateful for how they, the artists beyond them, have illuminated their work. And sometimes it comes crashing down and you do end up with that playwright at the back of the room, biting their nails and slinking down and frowning and a mess. And I've been there and I've sat through those moments and I've watched other playwrights and I've talked to other playwrights who've lived through that. So it is a matter of trust, right? And some playwrights don't care. They don't like they are at heart writers and they don't want to muck about in the rehearsal hall. They trust that what is going to come from the production, out of the production, is going to be much better than anything they could have imagined. And very often that may be true. I'm such an image-driven playwright. I see imagery on stage and I see movement and texture, physical textures all the time. So it's really hard for me not to direct while I'm writing. So I'm already directing. I'm already saying to the play and to the readers, this has to happen this way if it's going to work. So don't do anything else. Just do this. Now, sometimes I might be wrong and I might get a director who say, can we just try something else? And I have to trust that they understand my anxiety and they understand, and I have to understand that they may have a vision. So it does work both ways and it's a give and take. I will say that it's evolved quite a bit and that there's been a lot of really great realizations and understandings about that relationship or those relationships over the last 20 years, and even granting agencies and funding bodies and theaters have come to understand that to some level that's a necessity. Whereas before, and I think it's from negative repercussions and negative results of a production that they go, there's got to be a better process. So yeah, that's kind of a long-winded way of suggesting that I think you're right.
No, I agree. I agree completely. And I would like to think that, you know, as budgets shrink for opportunities in this country, that we are by nature collaborators. And so many of the new work that's being done now is a collaborative effort for a whole bunch of reasons. And now we're moving into a lot of discussions about diversity and casting. And to make that sort of thing happen, you need to turn to playwrights who are interested in reimagining what they might have written for something a bit more diverse. And then artistic and associate directors and creative teams to think along those lines. And so you really can only do that collaboratively. I think inherent in the actual creative process of any genre in the arts really is trust. Unless you're a podcaster and then you just sit in a room by yourself staring at the walls thinking, nobody to talk to except the telephone.
That's right.
So yeah, I think we do walk that fine line between wanting integrity dramatically on stage and yet wanting to trust everybody.
Right.
So I just want to jump forward a bit because I do want to focus a lot on the work that you are doing and have done with young people, because I know that that's a real passion of yours to hold workshops. I know during the pandemic you've had a couple of online workshops that you've offered, but pre-pandemic, in the pre-times, as they say, you've sat in rooms with young writers. What's sort of been your process in what does day one look like when you begin working with a group of young people?
Well, there's two separate activities that, if I'm working with playwrights, with young writers, it's different than if I'm working in a room where we are creating, a work, a production. And I've done a lot of both. When it comes to, I'll start with the writing, working with young writers, aspiring playwrights, et cetera. First of all, just instilling in them the idea, and this is not just for writers, of course, this is artists in general, and in our case, theater artists, but the first thing that I try to do with them is instill in them the idea that what separates them from the next writer, from the next artist, is them, is themselves. They are what makes them different and unique. And generally, when you start out as a writer, when you start out as a theater artist, your desire and your abilities revolve around imitation, right? You do what you know, and you know things from having watched other people do them. And so you take on, you want to write in a certain style. You want to write like a certain writer. You want to write a play like this play, or you want to perform in a certain style. You want to emulate certain actors or certain acting styles. It could be any number of things. And that comes with musicians, et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing that I try to instill in young writers, and this goes all the way back to teaching high school, creative writing class in high school, and trying to actively engage their voice. So who are you? The biggest question is, who are you? And so we talk about that at the beginning, that I want to hear from you. And that is a frightening thing. It's a frightening thing for anyone, let alone a 16-year-old or a 19-year-old who's just starting. And I now am challenging them to reveal something about themselves. But of course, the greatest art is ultra, ultra personal. And by it being so incredibly personal, it becomes universal. And so what we engage in when we find beauty or truth in art is that the individual, the artist, has found the truth for themselves and is not afraid in some way to risk revealing that truth of how they feel about this thing or how their world is reflected in this thing. And so with each individual at the table or wherever we are, it's about trying to give them a sense that what they really, really care about, what they really, really want to say, is what ultimately is most important. Then the other thing I say is, what you're going to write today is probably not your oeuvre that is going to make you famous. Very, very often, writers, and not just young writers, but aspiring writers, new writers, think that that the brilliance is just going to spew out once they get going because they know how to write and they have good ideas. So those two things must be able to come together and they're going to write something amazing. And it starts to get lost on the way. And I have to say to them, do not get discouraged that it's getting lost on the way, because it's going to get lost. You are going to hate your writing. And if you hate your writing, that's good. There's nothing wrong with hating your writing initially, because you're learning what good writing is by identifying what bad writing is, what you don't like about your writing, and you're going to fix it next time, and you're going to write something new, and you're going to write and write and write. I often tell young new playwrights, write a play and then throw it out. Then write another play and throw it out. Then write a third play and maybe have a few friends read it with you and then throw it out. So the idea is your fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth play are going to be better than your first. And that's what we're going to pay attention to. But you have to find your voice. You have to find what you care about, what really means something to you. And don't write the things that we want to hear, because we want to hear you. That's what we really want to focus on. And then the other aspect is they have a good idea, but they don't know where to start. Right. So the idea is there. They tell me this idea. It's thematically driven, right? It's, I want to write about this cause or this fight for justice or this moment in the world and that kind of thing. And I go, okay, who's your main character? And they don't know. They don't have a character. And I go, okay, well, we're on stage. You're on stage and we're an audience and we need to see something happening in front of us. So find a character and make them struggle with something or with someone, and let that be your first scene or your first moment. Doesn't have to be the first scene of the play eventually, but it's got to start somewhere. So the getting started, how do I push through is really what we start to talk about when we start talking technically. When it comes to the other side of it is I've done so much work developing plays with young people in a collective and in a devised way where we are mucking about with a script, possibly a script that I've written or co-written with some of them, and then we're now going to play around with it and go about developing it over the course of many weeks of workshops and things like that. And what we start with is just a whole lot of physical improv and them getting used to their bodies and taking big, big risks through improvisation, both physical and just regular kind of improv games and stuff like that. And then every so often taking a look at the script and playing with it, but just never getting at a table, never necessarily sitting down and doing a reading, although we've certainly done those aspects of it too, but just playing in a constant sense of play. And the sense of play that they develop allows them to learn how to take risks with text over time and physicality. If you go to a high school play and watch high school actors on stage, the first thing you notice the thing that I note most is that they are perfectly happy. They are perfectly able to emote the lines. They are perfectly capable of saying the lines with emotion and some sense of meaning. And by some sense of meaning, I mean inflection. They say the line and then the line comes out in a certain way. And so that's what's considered in high school. That's what's considered the skill. I'm clear. I say my line clearly and I have the right inflection and emotion to the line. And what I constantly, when I watch high school plays, because I do go to high school plays because I know so many teachers and my background's in education, what I notice is they paid no attention to listening. So nobody's actually reacting, which is an ultimate skill in acting, is the reacting. So there's no one listening. They're just waiting for the next line, their next cue, and then they engage and say their line. And then the other aspect is their body is not responding in any way, shape, or form to what's going on, to what's actually happening in the space, in space and time. What's your body doing? We don't stand like this. We never stand there and just have these kinds of, you know, it looks so incredibly unreal. And so we in our workshops and things like that, when I work with young people, like I did at Persephone and high schools, we just tear all that down and we start to play with the physicality of your body and what your body can do and all the possibilities. So those are the two aspects of working with young people that I focus on the most from the writing perspective in one case, and then from the just development of the person as a performance piece, you know, that kind of thing.
Though you can't see me apart from me sitting in my pandemic sweats, I have the biggest smile on my face right now because everything you've just said in the last few minutes is so in line with the way I approach working with young people in musical theater. And it's just so refreshing to get that kind of confirmation. Sometimes I have to fight the urge to say, just fucking do something.
Yeah,
make a choice, you know, just because, and I don't know how you feel about this, but it can be tough for that demographic, for that age category. It can be tough to break down that wall of too cool for school kind of thing, you know, like I'm not going to let my emotions show because that's just too uncool and I don't want to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. How do you break through that wall?
Well, I mean, that's because of fear, right? So they're living with fear, and the fear is don't want to get too dramatic about the idea of what fear is, but it's the fear of being wrong. It's the fear of sticking out. It's the fear of taking a risk. And yet, astoundingly, the best actors, the best performers are risk takers. They've become not afraid to take risks. So the first thing I do is we are as a group, but we don't single anybody out. We don't make people get up and be performers. We all work together as a group of 20 young people and myself, and I play all the games. I roll around, I muck about, I do. So they see me taking risks too. I can't roll around and muck about the way I used to. I have to watch my knees and ankles and hips and stuff like that. But I still try, or it's still, you know, whatever. And really what you're doing is showing them that risk is good, that risk is okay. And so they're pushing themselves, but it's physical, right? So they're least afraid of doing something physical, and if they can do it in a group. So literally just jumping up and down and running around a space and playing tag and and becoming children again in a physical way and abandoning the inhibitions that they carry with them on a daily basis in a, say, in a high school setting or even in a university setting where being cool is so important and how people perceive you is so important. Well, we get rid of, over time and over a lot of workshops and things like that, we get rid of a lot of that through a ton of games from a variety of teaching methods and physical theater teaching methods that I've kind of accumulated over the years through workshops that I've done or books that I've read or watched. Gosh, I'll watch a YouTube video just to go, oh, that's so cool. I think I can create an exercise around that. And starting to teach young people about what their bodies can do and how a group of bodies in space can express an emotion or an idea without words, and that thing is probably more powerful than any amount of I'm going to stand here and emote the shit out of this line. You know, like, that's just useless. We all can do that. You're not impressing us by showing us how upset you can get at this moment. So that's kind of where it comes from, is just breaking all of those barriers down and learning as a group to trust each other, right? That because, of course, the idea of a safe space is a big part of that. So when we get into a space together, your risk-taking is going to be rewarded, and we are not going to judge you. We are going to not just not judge you, we are going to embrace the choice you make by turning it into something really cool. So do not be afraid of those choices. So yeah, it's very much a physical, generally very little dialogue, very little talking happening in the first couple of weeks. It's there's music playing, there's moving, really moving quickly and fast to the next thing and not thinking about it and just go, go, go. And so the instincts that they have start to come out, like these base instincts that they live with and they have, but they push them down for the sake of being cool around their peers and stuff.
You know, I used to think that the biggest high that I get is performing, and it is. But the next biggest high to that, apart from some really good dark chocolate, is seeing that transformation when I'm working with young people. And I don't get the luxury of the time that you have. I'm working, I get maybe 15 minutes with somebody because we're in a festival setting. But
right.
When I'm evaluating some of these performers and I know nothing about them, and maybe it's informed by me and the way I grew up and all of my insecurities and all the hurdles that I've had to cross and jump over. But, a lot of the people that win their class, I have parents come up weeping afterwards saying to me, you have no idea, but this is the first time my daughter has ever performed in musical festival. And she scores very high on the spectrum, is in a special class in school.
Right.
And this is like the least likely thing I would have imagined
right.
her doing. And she won first place. And I said, I would not know that from watching her, but what I would know is she was fearless because she
right.
didn't know the trappings of get up, you know, acting consists of moving my right arm
right.
and then, you know, looking to the left on this particular word and looking through people that are on stage rather than looking at them. And she just turned herself over to the play
yeah.
of it all.
Yeah.
And that it's so, so lovely to see that happen innately for a person rather than having to drag them there kicking and screaming. I would attribute Michael Dobbin and Keith Turnbull. I don't know if you know Keith from the National. He taught for years at the National Theatre School in Montreal.
Oh, yeah.
They just let me go places I would never, ever dare
mm-hmm.
go. And sometimes it made no sense,
right.
You know, and sometimes I would be a puddle on the floor
right.
just bawling my eyes out because I went somewhere I would never, ever go before.
Right.
I'm always getting kids to go, you know what, this is something humorous that you're saying, but I want you to cry, fake cry
yeah.
through everything you're just saying. And now something really sad, I want you to just get absolutely so stupidly giddy,
right.
play the opposites,
mm-hmm.
and it's
yep.
in somewhere in the opposites you find the truth.
Yeah.
But if you never give yourself a chance to go there, you'll never, ever give
that's
yourself
right.
the privilege of finding your own voice and
that's
your own
right.
choices.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe that's part of the process that you were describing with writing, to throw out the first one and the second one and the third one, to just break down that I have to do, it has to be right the first time.
Yeah.
Okay, it wasn't right the first time. No, it's going to be right the second time. No, it doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't have to be right until it's ready for you.
Right.
The timing is for you to find the voice.
Yeah. I'm working on a play right now that is probably on its 12th draft, easily, probably more than that. And it's been in the works for about 8 years, and I'm working with the same actress, and it's a one-person show, and we just take our time, and it evolves, and it changes, and we build towards something. And it's amazing to talk to young writers and say, you know, good writing is in rewriting, right? The great, like the inspiration comes bit in bits and spurts and things like that. But the slogging away and fixing is where the great writing actually lives. And without that, without your ability to do that, you're never going to get anywhere, because no one can do the rewriting for you. You have to both recognize when something is wrong, listen to people when they say, not sure about this part or whatever they need to tell you, and that you take it in with an open mind and go, oh, maybe they're right, instead of protecting yourself with ego and going, I'm not changing that. I love that, you know, that kind of thing. And so the great writing is in the rewriting, is in the redrafting, is all of that. So it's a given when I work with young people and they don't understand initially, I go, well, this is not your last draft. You got 3 more drafts to go before we pay attention to this. So, you know, and you're like, what? Yeah, that's the way it goes. Yeah, so, yeah, it's a big thing.
If it's true, if the adage, write what you know, is true, let's just, for the sake of argument, let's just say, for my example, that is true. Maybe there is a place to write what you don't know. But let's, going on the premise of write what you know, if you're a fairly open person and fairly in tap with your emotions, if what you know is something highly volatile and emotionally charged because it's based on your own life experience, how do you go there as a playwright without, you know, having a mental breakdown every time you pick up the pen, to the point where you can't, because it touches on it, it's a trigger. Your writing becomes a trigger and you just, you know, collapse in an emotional heap, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And the writing doesn't get done.
Yeah. So I deal with quite a few emerging writers, some of whom have had traumas in their lives that they want to write about, or they feel that they want to write about, or they think, you know, they have an inkling that this is where they're going with it or something like that. And, well, here's the challenge, right? If it's writing as therapy, which is really valuable and important and something I do at the hospital, then there's a valid element to that that is going to be incredibly beneficial to you personally. But of course, if you're that's all you want to do, then you should go and do that. But as an audience, we don't know this about you, and we are here to see a play, or we're here to read something, and we don't necessarily see what you're seeing. And so it's very difficult to turn that into something, unless you can remove over time, unless you can remove aspects of the true events of your life into something that has structure and a certain level of content that breaks out of it just as a way to get this stuff out. Now, having said that, some of the most amazing pieces of writing come from a place deep, deep inside someone who is exercising a deep-seated piece of trauma or experience or yearning that they want to get out. And if they can combine those two things, they may have something really, really special, whether it's on stage or in some other aspect of writing, whether it's poetry or prose or anything. I find that when people are writing from that place, that difficult place, they have to spend some time working it out for themselves first. I don't mean that I'm not going to read it or not going to participate with them, but gradually it becomes a piece of art, and it's gradual, right? Writing something out on page and just getting it all out isn't necessarily a piece of art in terms of how it's going to be shared with the world. But over time, it can become that. And so I never, ever suggest to someone who has an experience that they want to write about that is true, like true, right? What you know, it's my trauma, it's my event. I never suggest that they shouldn't write that. In fact, I go for it. Just go for it. And we'll see what it feels like on the other end. Because once you do that, you can then read it and suddenly you are slightly separated from the experience on the page. You are now participating in it slightly differently. And you can then start to make judgments about whether it's the thing you really wanted it to be, or whether now it's malleable and you can shape it into something. I've listened to a lot of people. I've read several, like all kinds of things about the write what you know adage, right? And all of that. And it's such a silly thing in a certain sense, because of course we're writing what we know. We don't know anything other than we know. So in some way we're going to write about that. Even if we think we're writing about something else, what we know is going to find its way through. So in a certain sense, you're always writing what you know. But I always think, and I've heard other writers talk about this, right? It's more about write what you want to know, because great art is in the question. It's not in the answer. You don't write something to tell everybody, this is how this thing is. You're actually just posing a little question to the world in your writing as a playwright. And that question is burning at you. You want to discover or uncover some kernel of understanding in that thing. And you put it out into the world in a play, as a play, for example. And the audience takes that question and is driving home at night trying to engage in that question or come up with the answer. The question is still there and it just lives, right? We should not be trying to answer our own question. The question is for the world to try to break down, to try to understand at a more deep level, to try to really muscle and muck about with and discover, well, what does this thing mean to me? That's what a great question is, or what a great play is, and what great art is, right? It's always leaving you with a sense of wonder and mystery and a lightness to what you've experienced that brightens your world and illuminates something, and you're not quite sure how it did, but it has changed you. So I kind of went off to where this goes in terms of how you write what you know and write what you understand, but really it's write what is passionately driving you, right? Write that desire, write the desire, and make that thing the thing that you want to know. And the thing that's, if you write what you know, then you're just telling us stuff and it might as well be a TED talk or something. But if you write what you want to know, if you really are curious and really don't have all the answers, which you don't anyway, then we are going to be curious as an audience, as readers. We are going to also have questions, and good questions, not bad questions where we go, what the hell is this about? Oh, I don't understand it. That kind of thing.
You touched briefly on it when you said the work we do at the hospital. Tell me about that program at the hospital.
Oh, right. So I'm writer in residence at St. Paul's Hospital in Saskatoon, and a part of a healing arts team. Our group is called the Healing Arts, and it's part of St. Paul's mission. And as a team, there's a visual artist who is actually full time. She's kind of the lead in a certain way. And we have a couple of music therapists and then myself as a visual artist, as a writer in residence. And we just do whatever we feel benefits the patients and staff at the hospital. So it might be me reading to a patient. I have spent a fair bit of time over the last several months reading to patients who either don't have the ability to read, they're blind, or they are suffering and they want just to share time and they have something that they'd like to have read, all the way to helping. I'm working with a nurse right now who wants to be a creative writer, and she's writing voraciously, and she's writing about her own experiences in the hospital with patients, etc. And then everything in between. I have a cart that I take from floor to floor from time to time and bring crosswords and word searches to people who are incredibly bored and are looking for a friendly face, a conversation, and then I can drop something off. And then bring books that people might, novels and things like that, that people might read. So it's a really wide variety of things. I'm in the process of starting a staff writing workshop and things like that, and everything in between. So we do a lot of just care in a holistic way for patients and staff at the hospital. In fact, we lead a meditation every day at just around noon for staff to come and do a quick 10-minute, 15-minute meditation. And so we do a whole variety of things like that.
It's really beautiful. How has this program functioned during these COVID times?
Well, I'm going to say with great difficulty, although we have we've worked our way through a whole variety of things. So we are really, of course, we're in a hospital. So we're, no one's more aware of restrictions and things like that and being careful than people in a hospital, I would argue. And so there are lots of restrictions. There are certain parts of the, it's being relaxed, but there's certain areas that were kind of no-go areas because they were the COVID areas and things like that. But even then, I worked with a man who is visually impaired, who wants to write his story about his disability and how he overcame it. And I was on the COVID floor working with him in his room for several days. You just go in with full PPE and you keep your distance and you pay attention to all the rules and regulations. So we kind of have powered through it in a whole variety of ways. What we can't do, which is really disheartening, is bring people together in a space to sing some songs or to share stories. So that's not allowed. You can't put up a poster and say, Dan's going to be reading from this book or these poems or something like that. Come on down right to the lounge area, that kind of thing. So all of those are off limits. So what you have to do is really work from room to room and be aware of any room that has a precaution on it, restrictions, and follow them to a T, and just be extremely careful. But, and Marlisa, our visual artist, she has a visual art studio on the main floor. So that's restricted in terms of the number of people who can come down at any one time to visit and to paint or draw or just hang out, right? Lots of people just want someone to visit with them who is not just there to put in a catheter or move them or clean something or something like that. So just having someone there to listen to them. I've come in to see if someone wants a piece of reading material or a crossword, and I just spend time sitting and listening to their life story, and I'm perfectly happy to do that. So it's incredible to learn and to meet these people. So there's a whole variety of things that we do, and we understand that the art is a sideline to just in the interactions and all of that. We are able to use our art form as a way to make connections.
How's the pandemic been for you personally?
I guess I'm, for a while it didn't seem all that different because I was, as a playwright, as a writer, I was doing a lot of heavy duty writing when it hit. And then the university classes I teach and was teaching went online. So in a certain sense, that was not a huge transition. It was a lot of work to turn all the classes into something that works online. And I had already been teaching an online class before that, just an actual online class. So it wasn't too much of a leap to do new classes in that way. It's lonely for all of us, I think. I miss real physical contact with people, hugging and just physical touch and all of that kind of thing that is natural for friends and family and all of that kind of thing. And I found that for a while I had to stop writing. I just couldn't write. I just was not motivated. I got going for a while because I thought, wow, this is a perfect opportunity. And then it all kind of fizzled and I lost interest in it in that way. It's rekindled partly because I'm at the hospital. So you start to move around and meet people and see people. But until I started working at the hospital 5 months ago, I was really in a place where I was just kind of floating around, not sure what I was doing. I have a 4-year-old son, so he is the focus of our lives. And so in a certain sense, it's great. We've had so many incredible interactions and ways to just share time with him in ways that might not be possible pre-pandemic or not as frequent. But at the same time, he's getting too much of his parents too, right? He needs kids around and all of that. Now, he goes to daycare and all of that, but it's just still fairly restrictive. And there's this sense of care and caution with everything. So all of those things are weird. We moved, we sold a house in the fall and moved to another house, which we had kind of half thought of doing before. And then suddenly it seemed like the best time to do it. And a lot of people have been doing that. So it's been this weird combination of very positive things, very good things, very productive things at times, all the way to, I don't even know what I'm doing. I don't care. You know, I just, who gives a shit? You know, all of that kind of this. I walked out of the hospital the other day after a day in the hospital, and I just said to myself, the pandemic is the most confusing thing because I'm not sure what to think. I'm not sure how to feel. I'm upset, but I shouldn't be. I'm privileged, but I'm angry. All of these things would fly around, and it's hard to make sense of it all. And I'm angry at politicians, and angry, you know, all of these frustrations come out, and you really don't know because you're so out of control of so many things in some ways. So it's been a weird kind of thing, I would have to say, both good and bad. And I feel most for anytime I get bitchy or something like that, I just think of all the people who are suffering so much more and have really suffered greatly because of it. And, you know, I have to take my licks the way they are.
There's no pandemic playbook. We didn't write that one.
Nothing. And you know what? I mean, we might get into theater post-pandemic, during pandemic and stuff like that, which is such an interesting thing to talk about. But you're right. Like, it seems like such a uncontrollable, ungraspable thing in certain ways that it's all of so many different things at once that it's hard to kind of get a sense of what it is. And, you know, the last thing I really want to write about is a play about the pandemic, or a play that is even set in the pandemic. That could happen,
yeah.
But I just have no desire to be a part of it because I'm living it so intensely all the time, especially roaming the hospital and every single person is in a mask and every single person keeps their distance, you know, that kind of thing. So there's all of this sense that, you know, you just kind of in this zone of endless kind of drifting and not being sure, this endless sense of uncertainty and stuff. So yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm working on a play right now that is so much about isolation and loneliness, but this is a play that I've been working on for several years. And now it's crystallizing in a certain way what it can be about without ever it being about the pandemic or talking about or mentioning COVID or masks or anything. It can still be about that thing because it's about mental health. It's about depression. It's about mental illness. And it's about serious isolation and darkness, and it just goes dark in various ways. So there you go. That's going to be my pandemic play, I guess.
Well, I can relate, and I think a lot of people can relate to all of that roller coaster of emotions that you've experienced. But it sounds like you've maintained a remarkable level of creativity, apart from the point where you just didn't want to write. You've stayed engaged, which is something that a lot of people just said, I thought I was going to write the great novel of all time, and I just don't care.
Don't care.
I'm just walking around in this stupor of what in the world is going on, and I just have lost my mojo.
Yeah. Well, the first thing that got me moving was when I offered a couple of free online playwriting classes last spring. And I threw them on a Facebook. I created a Facebook page for them and just threw them out to the province. And I had 40 people in two different classes. And people were excited and really were happy to do it. And I reconnected with people I knew that I hadn't been in contact with for some time. And then all summer, every 2 weeks, the classes alternated week to week. Every week, so I was meeting with that group. I had a beginner and then a kind of a more advanced class. And it was so fun to just engage and hear what people's questions were and talk about art and theater and give people ideas or hear people's writing and what they wanted to do. And it didn't, and the stakes were so low, right? Nobody needed to end up finishing something. Nobody needed to write the ultimate play. Some people were just there to find out what is a play. How does it work? What do you do? That kind of thing, and had no aspirations that they were going to even write or finish something. But we got to be together on Zoom and just kind of chat and spend time together in a really creative environment, and it was really fun, and I really looked forward to it. I'm probably going to do it again this year, maybe with a few differences, but I'd like to reboot it for the next round of people or some of the people who want to do it again and maybe want to really do it this time, like write something. It was pretty cool to engage in those people. So I really had a really great time. And then on the heels of that, I started working at the hospital. So things took off, and I knew that these were the things that I needed in order not to just dig myself into a hole and cover myself up and just kind of stop everything. So that's kind of what kept me going. I mean, it's a lot of work now. I mean, I got really busy last, like people would be like, what are you doing? And I have not been busier. I am teaching 3 university classes online right now. I'm at the hospital. At the time I was running the GTNT New Voices program. We were in the throes of the workshops and things. So it was crazy town. And so at a certain point it was too crazy. So it kept me out of that doldrum though, of feeling sorry for myself and stuff like that, which is fantastic.
And won't it be great post-pandemic when a physical curtain goes up and there's an audience sitting there and they're not spaced 2 meters apart and everybody can breathe without a mask and we can finally experience that magic that is live theater.
Yeah, I'm terrified to even wish for it, you know, like in some ways I just can't imagine that happening, even though it has to and it will. I just find it, I was watching, interestingly you mentioned that, because I was watching on TV the film version of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yeah.
And I watched it and I knew it was a play and I was curious what they had, you know, what the adaptation would be. And of course, you can so often tell, almost always tell, when a movie has been a play first, because the locations are limited, the dialogue is heavy, and the scenes are long and all of that. And I'm watching this play and I turned to my wife and I said, I got to tell you that even though this is great and well done, I would give anything to be sitting in a theater with 300 or 400 people elbow to elbow and listening to this and experiencing this on stage with these guys and their instruments and talking about Ma Rainey and working out shit on about the jazz that they're playing and stuff like that. That would be exciting. This is just a movie. Like, I'm just sitting here with you talking about stuff and it's just a movie. And it spoke so clearly to me about the visceral and so important nature of theater and how theater does something that nothing else can do in that way, you know, I mean, other than say dance and opera and stuff, but that kind of performance where you're just there and you are not breathing, you're listening so intensely to what's going on stage. And I'm sorry, but you can do as many stage adaptations of, film adaptations of a stage play, and I'll take it in and it'll be good, but it's not the same experience at all. So,
no, because I think the very nature of live performance in this stage is that even with a play like Ma Rainey or Fences.
Yeah, Fences.
And several of the other works. The very nature of live theater is that we take emotion and put it on stage, and it is a heightened emotion. And I agree. I feel that way about most, pretty well all musicals done for film as well. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Why? This doesn't even make sense. This was not meant to be put in front of a lens.
Right. That's right.
You know,
yeah.
The greatest joy I'd have to say for me during this pandemic, because I will admit it has been really, really challenging to stay creative. It's been such a gift for Mark Claxton and the SATP to invite me to do this series of Theater in Saskatchewan podcasts, because every single one of these conversations with you, with Yvette Nolan, mm-hmm. with Henry Wolfe, just, I can literally feel my pulse pick up, and I am reminded why I chose this insane lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me re-energized every time. So thank you for the gift of your voice and your stories. I could not agree with you more on everything that you say. And maybe it's just something in the maritime water, but we're preaching the same thing from the same pulpit. And for that, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I'm happy that we got to talk. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. It was my pleasure. It was great to chat about these things. Fantastic. Thank you, Kevin. It was great.
Hey, thanks for listening. Music for Saskapes is provided by Saskatchewan-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Straker. Saskapes can be downloaded from iTunes, Google Play, the Saskapes app for Android devices, and all of the other major podcasting apps. Stop by and say hi to us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Saskapes. So tell me, what fuels the culture in your community? Who has a story that must be heard? Consider bringing Saskapes to your part of the province. Email us at saskapes@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Please share your thoughts on this episode or any of the episodes by writing a review in the iTunes Store or Google Play. Your star ratings help our audience grow. Remember, our stories are our legacy. Now, somewhere around the world for years to come, stories like those found in Saskapes are being heard. Think about it. We're creating an oral archive so that who we are in this province is never forgotten. I'm Kevin Power. Join me again next time.